Never understood the concept of barnacles. And hello, welcome back to a more regular episode of Stardub after their extra special sweetie Stardub After Dark special.
Which was a little bit rapey.
Which was a little bit rapey. My name's Ralph.
I'm Andy.
And hello to Nick Roche.
Yes.
Now, once again, the mission statement of the podcast is that we're here to discuss the more obscure aspects of pop culture, or perhaps the elements that just aren't discussed enough. In today's episode,
We resolve an exciting cliffhanger from last time.
We look into the contemporary dancing arts craze sweeping the movies near you.
We look at two comics in particular, one from an American event, which I'm not going to go into, and another, in the interest of being fair and balanced, as in Stardub After Dark, we gave convention comics from America something of a shit-kicking. We're going to give it a slightly more favourable viewpoint this time around.
So, our first exciting 30-second item today. In the last thrilling episode of Stardub, we reviewed some triumphant comics from listener
young Little Philip Ayers.
Little Philip Ayers. Hello, Little Philip Ayers. How are you? Anyway, we read these comics, and Andy wanted to destroy them. He wanted to rip them up in front of my very eyes. A bit like when Molar Ram goes up to that chap in Indiana Jones, the Temple of Doom, and pulls out his still-beating heart, and holds his still-beating heart in front of him, and the guy goes,
So what you're saying is that if I were to deprive you of triumphant comics, you couldn't live.
No, I'm just saying, as I said before, that literature, no matter how bad, should never be destroyed.
But as I said to you,
not in front of me.
It would then get put into the recycling bin, and it would be
recycled. That's a different thing. Actually, anyway. So the exciting cliffhanger resolution is that Little Philip Ayers was going to get back to us and tell us what to do with these comics. What are we to do with these comics, Andy?
Well, I'm not allowed to destroy them, but what we've been instructed to do is to charity shop them once again, but with a little note in between them, basically telling people of the podcast, and whoever buys them has to try and get in contact with us to give us their thoughts. So they'll be given email addresses, Twitter handles and the like.
Indeed, and they'll go to the Oxfam bookshop in Edinburgh. One of them anyway, in the Morningside one probably. Of which one of later. Another mini cliffhanger. Anyway, talking of Oxfam, which brings us on to charities, which brings us on to
The recently finished, although as we're all pretty much still recovering, Auto Assembly 2012.
What is Auto Assembly 2012, Mr. Andy, who's one of the committee, one of the people who runs this convention?
Well, for me it's a blur. But for those of you that get the benefit of a reasonable night's sleep and some free time, it is Europe's largest Transformers convention. Basically, you can go along, buy lots of toys and comics, see lots of guests who worked on the comics, on the cartoon and animated movies over the years, meet new and interesting people who also share the same hobby as you, share a drink, have a bit of banter, and just generally have a great 3 or 4 days, depending on how long you're down.
Yeah, I feel generally quite thin while you're at it. I was on the, as mentioned briefly, at the start of the exciting special edition last episode, I was on the Toyfoo stall. Toyfoo, as you know, raised £4,002.65 for the charity's Middies Meals. This was the fourth year we've been running, although when I say we, just to point out, I have been just one of the monkeys who works on the stall. I've not been the brains behind the stall.
The brains behind the stall is young Nicholas Davidson.
Yes, who, as we speak right now, is stuck in an airport in New York.
Probably.
In an attempt to emigrate to America for 3 to 5 years to do a PhD about some science pitch involving soil. He is on his way, and we last heard from him, he was stuck in an airport in New York for at least 24 hours. Apparently there's a revolution going on with the passengers, where some of them are going to go jump into cars and just drive to the next destination. All 300 of them. He's already spent one night in a hotel, he's currently given up and is off to find somewhere else to stay, and hopes to get to his destination tomorrow. So as you can see, it's a great start for him in his new life abroad.
So, see, this is Nick's brainchild, so he obviously, it's highly unlikely he'll be back for the next couple of years.
In fact, he said he won't be definitely back this time next year for All Assembly 2013 to run the stall because of the holiday arrangements that they have at the university that he's going to be working at.
So, he will still be involved in Toyfoo. He will be our United States distribution operative.
Yes, he will still be buying lots of toys and stuff. But I will be running the stall Like Giaxis from Generation 2 with an iron hand.
Which kind of makes me the Liege Maximo hovering in the background, being enigmatic.
Indeed. So, and again, just to say to any of you who are listening, thank you very much for coming along and buying some stuff and donating to a good cause.
And for those who get donated toys and the like as well, thank you very much for your generosity.
All of that, there's two things to that. First of all, I'll add to that is that if you were at Auto Assembly, for whatever reason, but you're listening to this and for some strange, bizarre reason, enjoy our rantings, go Google Mary's Meals on YouTube. Not YouTube, you can Google it on YouTube. Google Mary's Meals on that internet type pad device you might have about you. And find out more about them and stick them 50 bob or something. Why don't you?
And also, if you are planning to come to Auto Assembly next year, or if you're even interested about it and haven't been to one before, go to www.autoassembly.org.uk. You see lots of details there and a handy way of booking your ticket for next year.
And near the time, we will be using all media elements available to us to ask for good quality donations for the stall at that time. So, I mean, obviously, there was, like, robots and shit there, and, like, artists and shit, and also shit in the toilets, but, for me, the highlight was actually nothing at all to do with any of this, but the fact that they had a £10 fish finger sandwich on the menu.
That, to be honest, what I'd say right now is that a £10 fish finger sandwich sounds like something you ask from the streets of Red Light District.
You would think so, but this was allegedly a Market 4-star hotel, Andy, attached to an international airport. So yes, of course there are many hookers in the vicinity, but not where I was looking anyway. Being a simple boy, I like my simple things. I like my cold £1 Greggs thing that's never put in a hot plate, that kind of thing. So they saw the menu, and they had a special menu for our attendees where the price was knocked down from what the fuck to wow, that's expensive. But on the regular menu they had a fish finger sandwich. Now for me, a fish finger sandwich is about as low rent as you can get. I mean, fish finger sandwiches is something that even your average greasy spoon does not touch, you know. I mean, even when people worked in pits down the mines looking for coal and monsters to sell for food, and they go, oh, I've got a hard life, I've got a really low life expectancy, look at those horses, they're not going to die because they don't get as much head as me and I get nothing. I've been down this mine since I was 10, I'm 34 and I'm going to die soon because I'm working down the mine. And even they would go back and they would have their simple fare, they'd have their really shitty grolic soup. Obviously I've studied history, the simple grolic soup and stuff, and not really good nutrition, but even they would go, fish finger sandwich? Shove it up your arse, I'm not having that. That's for the peasant folk. So anyway, so that's on the menu. I thought, I've got to have this £10 fish finger sandwich. So a cabal of us became the fish finger chumbadin.
So three of you then?
Four of us actually. And
not triumvirate then?
It's an extra special triumvirate. It's beyond triumvirate. If this was written down, the tri bit would be in capital letters. That's what makes it ironic. Anyway.
There would be four, so exactly. That's what we're
on. Exactly, yeah. So, I had the fish finger sandwich now. We made the foolish mistake before, and I wasn't having a foot-long sub from the local Subway, which was in the NEC. The NEC is the National Exhibition Centre of England. England. And I've never been there before.
It's a desolate
wasteland. If you imagine those shitty 70s science fiction films where they had the underground trains, they also had this big empty space beside it where three or four guys in uniforms would mill around in space uniforms, obviously. But they weren't even there. And what was obvious was there was a prayer room, however.
Right beside the chaplain's room.
Right beside the chaplain's room, near the security centre. So at least if you walked in looking for
spiritual comfort,
life in general, you'd find it. But there was a Subway there. This is important because I had a foot-long sub, and this meant that later on in the Saturday, I thought, right, enough of this Transformer pish. I'm getting my £10 fish finger sandwich, and it came, and it was three. Also, the other reason why we had to order it was because the description in the menu said Signature Series, which is very exciting, and Prime fish fillets, like Optimus Prime. Who's Transformer leader?
Whose signature dish is a fish?
So exactly. So that may be funnier. Maybe funnier. You go, see, it's your signature dish, goulash, signature dish quiche, signature dish chicken and sauce and herbs. Is the American say herbs. It annoys me, irritating, but terrible habit. Stop it. Very few people. Anyway, herbs and I don't know, vegetable shit and all this thrown in. and you go, can I have the fish finger sandwich, please? So it came. It came with its bowl of fucking cold fries in this 4-star hotel. And yeah, and what they did, and the bread had been toasted, which was an extra effort they went to, which wasn't even mentioned. It had the three bits of prime fish finger, and it was cut down the middle, and I ate this thing. And it was very filling, it was very nice. And it made my convention.
Oh, well, my convention was made by a conversation at a table, thanks to John Paul Beauvais, trying to kill me through the medium of laughter.
Indeed.
Photos are on Facebook, you will see me falling down. Bright red. Yep.
Yes, so I feel that with Auto Assembly this year having 773-ish indeterminate number of people, whereas previously it was 567,
I think.
You could say that in terms of success it's been a bit of a step up for Auto Assembly this year. Indeed, you could say it's as much of a step up perhaps as a film called Step Up 4 Miami Heat, aka Step Up Revolution in the States, which has just been released in Britain. What do you say, Sir Andy?
I'm having flashbacks and I want to cry.
Now, let's just set the scene.
Ralph was set a challenge by me.
Which you mentioned before.
At the start of the year.
Yes.
Because he lives basically a stone's throw from the local world of Sydney. He saw quite a few films last year, I think about
50
odd. So I said, can you do
it? Technically 49 and a half, because I walked out of Green Lantern because it wanted to make me poke my eyes out.
So that's important. Let's hang on that detail for a little bit.
We'll get back to that.
So I'd kind of jokingly said, go for 100. And Ralph, not having the sense he was born with, grasped that for me there and said, I'll do it. I'll do 100 for the year.
I will. And the thing is, and I thought this would be a good thing because I don't really watch television. I very rarely watch television. I just don't have time for it. I tend to listen to podcasts, radio plays, and read. And also, as I become older and cynical in most television, I just basically want to shake my fist at and rant. But I do like films. And I never get as much enjoyment out of seeing a film on a monitor or television screen as I will in a cinema. And not so much actually for the bigger screen, but for the sound, quality of sound. Being in rented accommodation, even if I got a really good sound set up, it'd be a complete waste of time because I'd switch it on and within 5 minutes all my neighbours would be at my door saying, what on earth are you doing? Because obviously I wouldn't be able to soundproof the property adequately. So as sound is very much my medium, that's the main reason why I like to see films in the cinema. So as mentioned before, today was film number 73, and as part of this cornucopia of cinematic delights this year, it means I have to actually go out with my boundaries sometimes. I have to see films I would not usually have bothered to see, or films I might have seen maybe a 3B or £3 picture special from the bargain bin. Anyway, I have a certain weakness for silly dance movies. Now let me explain what type of silly dance movie I mean. I'm not really interested in your High School Musicals. I'm not really interested in that particular subgenre. I also have very little interest in musicals. Which means sometimes I miss certain good films. I mean, I ignored this sound of music for absolutely years and years and years, and then someone told me that General Chang from Star Trek 6 was on, and then I watched it and I really enjoyed it actually, and then there were Nazis in it and no one told me that. They just anyway. And there's The Wizard of Oz, which is always a timeless classic, but generally most musicals are just but I do like it when you have a plot, a situation, a dilemma perhaps, that can only be solved by the characters using the power of dance to overcome all. Now obviously we think of classics such as Flashdance,
Footloose,
the Footloose duology, which is the creme de la creme, the top dollar, the maximus of this genre, where you have a town where dancing is banned and everyone's kind of repressed and depressed, and only by using the power of dance the people's minds open and they bring joy to their life and the community is revitalised. And both iterations of the Footloose genre, which is a genre in itself, demonstrate this. Already this year we've had the likes of Street Dance 2, which I enjoyed, because Street Dance 2 obeyed the rules. The rules are very simple. You have a quite tight 90 minute running time. You don't give the leads too much dialogue, because generally they're dancers, that's what they've been employed for. And you want bouncy tunes with very clear dance routines, pretty much almost like a stage play where they're facing you from the screen. And they dance around, and by dancing, you feel a wee bit happy in yourself, and they solve their problem. Street Dance 2 solved that. It wasn't a classic, but it passed 90 minutes quite pleasantly. I wouldn't say to rush out and see it. I wouldn't even recommend it, to be honest, because I understand it's very niche appeal. But, you know, it was okay, did the job. So in the last few months, I've seen the trailers for Step Up 4, Miami Heat, aka Step Up Revolution. And the trailer looks fantastic. This gave me young people on a beach in the sun and some evil property developer wanting to take away their neighbourhood and build a big hotel. And they appear to be using the power of dance to say, no, we will have none of this. So I thought, Andy despises these kind of films. I'll take him along with me to see it. So it's very
odd. Can I just preface this when they said you're taking me along? I paid for my own ticket, so you really didn't take me along. More, I accompanied you.
I escorted you. Dead air.
Yes. I paid for it.
Well, I paid for this as well. It's part of my monthly subscription. And also, it's film 73, so it gets me one step closer to the goal. And the last film I saw was Disney's Pixar's Brave, which I was actually a bit disappointed by. It wasn't the usual Pixar quality. Well, the animation was stunning. The storyline was not really up to scratch. So I'm looking forward to a bit of nonsense, especially due to some personal stuff going on, which I won't go into. I thought, here we go, a couple hours. Then the film began, and I found myself sinking into my seat, and I watched the stuff, and I just thought, I'm not enjoying this.
10 minutes in, I turned, craned across to Ralph and said, this is fucking awful. I did this probably about 7 or 8 times during the film.
This is very true.
Because it's a 90 minute film, whose plot really only begins about 40 minutes in.
Yes, the plot then of Step Up 4, because we can't be very much to tell you, the listeners, what it's about.
It starts off with this dance crew flash mob called The Mob, inventively enough, who just suddenly rock up in Miami, do shit, and get hits on YouTube for a competition where they'll get 100 grand if they get 10 million hits.
That is correct.
So that's the opening plot. The hotel that most of them seem to work for is kind of like minimum wage jobs, has a new owner, played by Peter Gallagher, whose alimony checks must be through the fucking roof.
Peter Gallagher, I believe, is a real actor.
Yes, I've seen him in things.
Yes, I've seen him in things as well. And give him his due, in his small, thankless role, he does a decent job and emotes with his eyes quite a lot.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because the dialogue's not really going to help.
He doesn't have a lot of dialogue, no.
But, so that's kind of their thing. Now, the boss's daughter appears, and...
Who is nicely filthy.
Yes.
And I liked her immediately, because from her very introduction, she started doing a filthy dance routine. And that joy started to come to my life again, because one of the things about the subgenre is there must always be a filthy dance routine lass who will get pounded by the lead at some point. But it's important to do the filthy dance. And she does a filthy dance, and I thought, oh, here we go, this is good. She never does this kind of filthy dancing ever again in the film.
Yes.
In fact, that's all your filth. That's it.
But it kind of ponders on, then all of a sudden the property...
It ponders on, the mob people keep doing their flash mobs, which are elaborate dance routines. And the problem with dance routines...
They're too elaborate.
It is actually part of the plot that they have, like, a guy who does FX for them and stunts and the like. But you find that you're not really watching a dance routine, you're watching a stunt routine, which becomes very old very quickly. Even though, I have to admit, there's a lot of skill on this. But the problem is that because they're done as sort of deliberately so, arty, stunt type things, the music is more fitting to that. It's not really what you would call like dance movie music. It's very stop starty, sometimes pretentious actually, because they've done sort of mixes for it. And so you don't really get that thing of bopping in your chair going, yeah, I like this tune, and look at them go. Boredom sets in, you think, these are the annoying pricks, all they care about is getting hits on YouTube. Ooh, even mock a character at one point, an older chap who's...
Who calls it the YouTubes,
which I thought was a great joke, and the characters in the film mocked him for it. So I thought, this is going on, we're not really getting... There's nothing about housing needing to be saved. The dance routines are not really grabbing me, the music's not really grabbing me, and there's no filth.
That's how it goes for it.
Then, kind of, really pretty much in the last third of the film, the evil property developer, who is the father of the lass who pretended to be filthy to get the audience excited and turned out not to be filthy.
Well, in all fairness, he's not really an evil property developer.
He's just indifferent. Yeah, and that's part of the problem as well, is that...
There's no hand-wringing and cackling.
Yeah, with these types of films, you need one or the other of these two elements, or you can have both. You need campening. Because obviously, this type of scenario is ludicrous. And you need a little bit of company, either from the plot, the story, the acting, or by bringing in a character actor and showing you how silly it was, which was done in Street Dance 2 with Tom Conti, an actual proper respected actor. He was brought in, and as soon as he's on screen, it ramped up the company, and you thought, well, that actually works for that type of film. But there's no company in this film, so you think, right, we're not going for that tone, but we need to have an evil property developer, so he needs to kind of be a character who is...
Does unpleasant things,
or even is given some direction for the actor to sort of twirl his invisible moustache.
Because the closest he gets to being evil is when he's having a meeting with all of the staff, and bear in mind he's just taken over the hotel complex, and one of our leads comes in late. Shuffles in late and kind of makes a shambolic excuse, and goes, I accept your apology, but you no longer work for us.
But the problem was that I actually agreed with the indifferent property offer, because the character who shuffled in, to be honest, really deserved to be fired, and had already shown himself as being not a particularly likeable character anyway. So I didn't feel for them.
Nope.
No. So the lumber's on for a while. The indifferent property guy says, I'm going to redevelop this neighbourhood and make it better for you all. So because you're all renting, away you go. And so then they think, right, we'll have to have one big elaborate dance routine at the end. And I thought, right, here we go, at least we'll get a really good thumping dance routine at the end. Now, it had one thing going for it, which was the mayor of the city. He starts getting into it as well. He's dancing away.
Like a dad.
Yeah, like a dad. And you think, yes, that's what's supposed to happen in this type of film. You should have a bit where one of the, not a villain, but someone who was maybe opposed to the heroes kind of goes, yeah, I can feel the dance and I want to change my mind. And that was great. But again, unfortunately, the music was kind of overly arty and overly mixed. And the routine was so overblown. Again, technically superb. I mean, there were some great stunts and the choreography was brilliant and all that business. But I just couldn't get into it. And so there they go. So it's not done very well in America. I don't know how it'll play in Europe. Probably not too well, I think, because...
Well, the 2D show we had to see was buried in the screen 13 up the back.
Yeah, the small screen, and it's only on during the daytime as well. The evening showings are in the 3D, and although 3D is not my thing, to put it mildly, even watching it, I don't think you'll get much more out of it being in 3D.
I didn't see anything that was really leaping off.
No, there was nothing particularly stereoscopic about the presentation of it, other than the credits, which I've noticed a lot in the films made for 3D, is you can always tell it's 3D if the credits are going like that and stuff. So so basically what you're better doing is going off and getting one of the two Footloose films or Flashdance.
Yes. Or just doing something else entirely different altogether.
Talking of doing something else entirely different altogether, let's talk about something entirely different altogether that the Uncanny X-Men did in the space year 1983. As always, I'll hand over this comic to our TAT comic reviewer expert, Mr. Turnbull. But I'll just do an introduction first.
By all means.
Talking of Oxfam earlier, one of the reasons why we really like Oxfam and why they tend to get all my spare comics and books when I don't have room for them anymore is because their bookshops are very, very good for comics. And a wide variety of comics, and they're a good place to look. Now, they do various little events and fairs from time to time, and sometimes you pick up some really strange things you've never seen before. And yes, I know you've got back issues on eBay, and that's great, but that's more for targeted searches.
Nothing beats walking up to a bricks and mortar place.
Yeah, bricks and mortar, a stall, or a charity shop,
or a fair or something.
Yeah, rifling through it and going, oh, there we go. So, one such comic, which we'll be going back to Oxfam, because generally I like to recycle my stuff from there. But I've got some enjoyment, is an advertising supplement to the Dallas Times Herald. Now, this advertising supplement is produced exactly like a comic of the time, and it has the title of The Uncanny X-Men at the State Fair of Texas. And at the bottom we're told it's a Dallas Times Herald feature. The cover, we've got Storm, we've got Cyclops, we've got big metal chap, his name is
Colossus.
Colossus, thank you. We've got him, who's Wolverine.
You've got all Red Indian on us, because we had enough races in the last one with Nick.
And there's Nightcrawler and stuff. Anyway, there's a giant man who is doing something. What's he doing?
I think it's some kind of state similar to Texas.
It's like a cowboy chap. Right. So, Turnbull, talk us through this comic.
Okay, so the X-Men lineup is kind of the... it's after Dark Phoenix saga, because it's got Kitty Pryde in her aerial costume, the yellow and brown one. It is perforated by, plotted by Jim Salakrit, long-time Spider-Man editor, and also wrote the dialogue to some of the first issues 2, 3 and 4 of Marvel US of Transformers. You might have heard of that comic.
Indeed.
David Kraft did the script. Kerry Gamill and Alan Kupperberg did pencils. Kerry Gamill's a very, very good penciler.
And Kupperberg as well, you may know from the Transformers.
He's a penciler.
Yes, he is a penciler, yes.
Long-time Marvel inker Chick Stone, who inked a lot of Jack Kirby's original Uncanny X-Men stuff back in the day, he's on inks. Rick Parker, long-time Spider-Man and Marvel US Transformers letterer, does letters. Mary Severin does the colours, and the cover was by Jazzy John Romita.
It's not too bad a lineup, actually.
Yes, you actually have a good... apart from Paul Kupperberg, Alan Kupperberg, sorry, Paul's brother who's an editor. It kicks off in the Danger Room with the X-Men being tested. It's a nice easy trope to kind of get in there. It introduces to anyone who doesn't know, quite quickly, who are the characters. Mm-hmm. Plays a little bit fast and loose with things. It has Cyclops as the leader. Now, technically, he stopped being the leader after he left in issue 1-3.
I'm just not sure if the Dallas Times Herald canon also is part of the Uncanny X-Men canon. You know, they might be different.
It's all in comic.
Okay.
So basically, just gives you a little test, shows you all the characters, what they can do, over his claws, crosses, his metallic skin, Cyclops, Optic Blast, just to kind of say, here you go, in a couple of pages, I've introduced you who the X-Men are. It's a lost art and something that modern comics fails to do.
And again, betrays the original origins of this as being a freebie with a newspaper.
And third page kind of has Professor X expounding on why they're there and about how the X-Men are there to find mutants to help them train for their powers and get better. And obviously the problem is Magneto and his evil mutants might find them. So there you go. Three pages, kind of giving you the basic raison d'etre for the X-Men, as it was back in the day.
Yeah.
Now here's where you get to the ads kicking in. Now, the best of it is, unlike most of the Marvel Universe back in the day, these ads are all kind of local.
Yeah,
which is quite unusual.
So you see adverts for like local electrical stores.
The Red Bird Mall, Boot Town. So it kind of gives you adverts for shops.
And they'll tend to be advertised by heroes. We've got Spider-Man Tips Halloween Festival advertised by Spider-Man. Then we have Boot Town, which is not a downmarket hooker's bar. It is in fact a place that sells children's boots. And the Hulk himself says, "Mama Hulk always took me to Boot Town for my boots," which is unusual.
Let's take a moment just to regard Ralph Hulk impersonation.
That was good. That was good.
Do you have another voice?
I'm using it right now. Don't mock me. Meanwhile, back in the story.
So you then cut to the state fair, and apparently some shadowy figure goes, "Here's a place I want." And there's a chap called Daniel Wiley who apparently is labouring for ordinary mortals. And the chap gets him some, gives him some many beguiling lies. And basically, it uncovers that the little boy can change into a centaur, so he's a mutant.
Mm.
Shadowy chap is obviously Magneto.
Shocking, really.
Oh, brilliant. Just to go away, because the adverts are actually brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Celebrate fall with Richie and Richard, our Octobears, in October.
I like that. That's good.
And that's flea market and maternity wear and just so basically Magneto's trying to get the centaur chap to join his mutants because apparently that's key to him ruling the world.
Yeah.
So a chap with horse bits is essential.
Horses for courses, really.
Nah.
Just have to hoof it. There we go.
Anyway, let's get back into the saddle.
Yes.
So basically, X-Men are in plain clothes. Points off for not mentioning that Nightcrawler is not using an image inducer, because you really don't get plain clothes if you're blue and furry.
But again, we don't know if this is the same canon. It might be different with the Dallas Times Herald.
So they're kind of looking about trying to find out where the guy is. So there's all sorts of stuff going on. There's like the Cotton Bowl, which I believe is kind of an American football type event.
Indeed.
So they keep wandering about, and basically the X-Men and skip through. There's some adverts.
This is good. It's a word search, right? And it says, "This is the leader of the X-Men, Professor X, who possesses great mental powers. He is thinking about these X words that rhyme." And there's big picture of his bonds and lots of letters across his bonds. He looks quite happy about it though, actually.
And then you got an advert for the local channel 21, which loves kids.
Yes, indeed. But innocent times.
Yes, but in all fairness, it's on after school, mm-hmm. 2 o'clock.
Yeah.
Why aren't they until like after 3?
Because
learn things, American children of the 80s. Learn things.
What have they got on their channel?
At 2 p.m. it's Inspector Gadget.
Good choice.
2:30 the Jetsons.
Bad choice.
3 o'clock, He-Man and the Masters of the Universe.
Yes.
3:30 Flintstones.
Poor choice.
4 p.m. Superheroes. Imagine that's all the formation stuff.
Okay. Good choice.
4:30 Batman. Good choice.
Which Batman mode do we think?
He'll be all the formation ones, so still a good choice.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that'll go. Yeah.
So basically, we like the after school.
Good. Excellent.
We've
got a very special page there. Now, this is a page introducing the X-Men, and they've got all pictures of them farting about.
Some unusual anatomy in the case of Wolverine looks like a bendy PVC figure.
It's true. He does look slightly rapey as well. I don't like the way he's lurching towards me.
It's true. Well done for whoever drew Ariel, which I think looks like it's based on a Paul Smith illustration, because they managed to remember that at this point Kitty Pryde is about 13, mm-hmm. so it doesn't need to have porn star breasts.
It's just a shame.
You sit over there. Move away from me.
No, I need to lean in closer.
No, you don't.
I do. Then there's an advert saying, "Does it seem like your allowance just doesn't buy as much these days? Are you tired of taking handouts from your folks?
God no.
Get a job! A great part-time job as a Dallas Times Herald newspaper carrier." Now, what doesn't help is the picture of the child. It just doesn't look...
I don't know what gender.
It's like... I think it's a mutant. I actually think it's a mutant because it's a bit... Well, I mean, the head shouldn't be that shape. The nose shouldn't be like that.
With a mullet.
It's got a very mournful expression, and it's been sent out by his parents with only a t-shirt which doesn't fit, a pair of shorts which are far too short.
Well, no, they're 80 shorts. They're proper shorts.
And a dynamic skateboard.
Yeah.
So there we go. Meanwhile, back in the story.
So basically, Magneto's trying not to have a fight with the X-Men until he's got the mutant kid. And he's trying to mislead the kid into telling him that the X-Men are evil, who they all walk up saying, "Let's talk." Best of it is, Professor Xavier's involved, so he's there with his dog blanket.
No, that's one of the things that's bothered me over the years, if all the Marvel merchandise is available, is you can buy X-Men action figures, and America had cereal, we never got it, you bastards.
Chef Boyardee things.
Yeah, but they are, and you can get blankets and towels. But where the fuck is my Professor X blanket for my knees? Because I would not leave the house. I would just sit there all day with my blanket over my knees going, "To me, my X-Men!" And then after a while, we realised that it was like dark and cold and there was no food. I would just say, "To me, heat, light and food! To me!" And I would have to get fitted with a catheter because I wouldn't want to take my blanket off to go and do the natural business in the loo. You know, I was like, "To the capital, my urine!"
So Magneto uses his powers to make horseshoes look like they're attacking him and Daniel, so he can blame it on the X-Men. So the kid then becomes his centaur self, and basically there's a fight. X-Men obviously trying to protect him and not get really hurt on because he's just been duped. Mm-hmm. And, well, there's another word.
Is it Professor X again?
Yeah.
It's the shouting word hunt.
Sadly, the answers are on the same page, upside down, but it's a word search. That's not difficult.
There we go, and then we have an advert for a regular comic.
It's the X-Men and Micronauts, which is the first appearance of Professor X being evil.
Yeah, that plot.
The first of many.
But we're back to the exciting storyline now.
Magneto's knocking them about, because obviously one of the X-Men has metal bones, the other one turns into metal. Yeah, you do the math. They're not really good.
Oh, here we go.
Professor X wants you to name the animals.
It's true. I don't know why he wants you to name the animals, but he really does.
What a dick.
Meanwhile, we've got Spider-Man advertising
VCRs.
He's advertising Dolphin Pool Supply, and he's also advertising the book on remodeling with Windows, which is unusual. But then, maybe he's a wall crawler, not really a window crawler.
So, basically, here comes the finale. Is the X-Men kind of win? It's all sorted. They know that the Sentinel Boy realizes that Magneto's a wrong-un.
He is.
And apparently, the boot of Big Tex, the big statue, kicked Magneto in the bum. Mm-hmm. And the kid thinks it's all about the X-Men. And Storm goes, "Oh, it must have been Cyclops with the power beam." And then the statue winks at everyone. The end. It's inoffensive.
There's a thing with Cyclops there. What we got? You can Cyclops needs his visor. Join the dots and hurry. Then color Cyclops. Oh, he's doing a voice. Doing a voice. I don't know his voice. I am Cyclops. Whatever you're doing, I'm going to stop you now. And then Spider-Man's talking about something.
There's a Bill Bendel into where basically Jim Shooter, the then editor in chief, kind of talks about stuff. And basically, there's a Dallas Times Herald publisher has a little chat saying, "Hope you enjoyed it," because mm-hmm. apparently there's two of them. So basically, the next one is the joint forces in Dallas, and the next one on Sunday, November 13th. And then there's an advert from Junior Mavericks Baseball Club. It's for boys and girls aged 15 and younger. And it's got a kind of creepy photo of a creepy guy.
Mm. Oh dear. Yeah, he looks a bit wrong, man.
In the back, Spider-Man advertising Morgan boots. Cowboy boots.
So they have it. Now, I feel that we've done a public service by educating all about this comic, because I looked up that internet thing, and the only information I could find was I found a thumbnail of the cover, and that was it. So this is the obscure of the obscure, as far as I can tell.
It's well produced. It does what it does.
It's fine for what it is. Yeah, it's actually not too bad. I know we're mocking it slightly, but it's affectionately.
Thing is, I'd be inclined to keep it more if it had art by Gamill all the way through, because when he's on page, it's not rubbish. It's not a half job. He's done a proper job. Mm. He's basically of the old school. Let's put in Kupperberg art. Is he does what he does, but I've never liked his work. It's threadbare. Its anatomy is problematic, and those two issues of Marvel Transformers were fucking horseshit.
I know, despite the fact those two issues of Transformers actually, I think, have some of the best scripting of any issues.
Yeah. Some of the tightest work from Uncle Bob, but
yeah,
he delivers a turd sandwich to say the least.
But talking of turd sandwiches, Andy, it's time for the secret surprise Turbo Taste Challenge! That's right! What Andy doesn't know is that I've got him a surprise. He thought we were about to move on to our final item, which we will, and you'll enjoy the final item even more, because that's actually a good thing. So, we'll let Turnbull just suffer in silence there while using the power of the audio medium, I walk out the room for 30 seconds.
Well, it can't really be worse, I don't think, than the chocolate cheese bread.
I don't think it's going to be as bad as that.
Might unnerve you. Oh, God, it's not willy-shaped, is it?
It might unnerve you.
It's willy-shaped.
What do I have in my hands?
Something willy-shaped. We've just come to that conclusion already. Stop putting it down your trousers!
What do I have in my hands? Now,
there's a natural order to things. And we all...
It's chaos eventually.
It's true. And we all enjoy certain things in certain forms. For instance, the hobnob biscuit. We all enjoy a good hobnob, especially if it's a chocolate hobnob. And the idea of that being in a bar form horrified me. Horrified me intensely. I thought, you can't have a hobnob in a bar form. But they did, and I had one, and I actually quite enjoyed it. Surprisingly enough. So then I found this other thing, which is also a biscuit variety, which we all enjoy, and it's been transformed into something quite horrific. Now I've already had one of these, I didn't enjoy it at all. So what we speak of course, are Jammy Dodgers. Now, Jammy Dodgers are a round biscuity sweet with a nice sort of strawberry type thingy bobby in the middle.
Usually like a little love heart.
You can see
the jam.
You can see the jam. It's a tasty tea time treat. It reminds you of your childhood. And thanks to the Doctor Who episode, Victory of the Daleks, we also know it can be used to get yourself away from a Dalek assault.
It's true.
So they've now brought out the Jammy Dodger biscuit bar. And the packaging, first of all, is not much to it. It just says Jammy Dodgers, it's sort of printed on it. And what it looks like, dear listeners, is if you imagine like a stick of frozen sick, it looks just like
it looks like a really rough urinal cake.
It really does look like it. Yeah, it's got a really urinal appearance to it as well. No, I enjoy a cereal bar. So first of all, let's have a good sniff. Let's have a good. How's it going?
It smells really nice.
It smells really nice. Okay, right. Stick it in your mouth.
No.
Not mine. Get it in you. He's now putting it in his mouth. He's giving it a good chomp. Okay, he's not looking too upset. I think it's going to be okay. Maybe you'll enjoy it. Could happen. Now, he obviously has to eat the entire bar to make sure he gets the full experience. I don't know, maybe it's going to be like astronaut food. You know, when you get like good food and they put on a strange new form and you chomp away and you think it's alright. Or maybe Andy will overcome his consternation at the Jammy Dodger not having, well, any biscuit in it.
That was my first point. Mm. It's really just it's like someone got Rice Krispies, coated them in jam.
Mm-hmm.
I'm no stranger to that, for I used to, in my youth, enjoy a jam and Rice Krispies sandwich every now and then.
What?
A jam and Rice Krispies sandwich.
No.
Get bread.
No.
Jam.
No.
Rice Krispies.
No.
Jam.
No, that's
bread.
No,
on that one.
No, that's even lower rent than the fish finger sandwich.
You've never had a...
No,
I've never lived.
I've never been, you know, I've never been particularly partial to Rice Krispies in the first place. I've never looked at a Rice Krispies and thought, oh, there's a good sandwich eating on that. I'll shove some jam at it.
You just need to experiment.
There's experimentation and there's, no.
Well, you've had me chocolate cheese for fuck's sake.
Yeah. Believe it or not, they still sell the chocolate cheese. It's now available in a new trial size. It didn't come and go as we thought it would. So you've just got one more bit to get down, yeah? Just get it all down, you. Come on. Take it all the way. Come on. Don't look at me with hate.
That's like I've fed you.
I fed you worse than this.
It's true.
It's true. Right, just, you can't give a full opinion until you... I can now verify for the purpose of audio the entire bar has went down his throat. He's just chomping on the last few bits just now. They're looking quite unhappy. He's now putting the wrapper in his pocket. This is very exciting. He's reaching for his glass, his Cyberman mug, which has some cherry coke. Cherry coke. He's thinking this might help. He's lifting it to his lips, like, I don't know, like that Bolt chap, but not running. He's washing it down, and now we can stand an awesome revelation for the verdict. Are we ready?
Right.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
It could do with some biscuit as opposed to Rice Krispies.
See, that's my problem with it. It's also, it's not round. But where's the biscuit?
There's no biscuit.
There's no biscuit.
It's just Rice Krispies and jam.
That's not a jam, Dodger.
It's not even a Rice Krispies jam.
No.
Next time you have a tumble tip, if you're having a Rice Krispies jam.
I don't like jam on a sandwich in the first place. I like jam on its own. Because if I was to have to eat a jam sandwich, I would feel like I was in a bit of a jam. So, yes.
You should apologise for that.
No, I won't apologise for that. Okay, so that wasn't too bad, was it?
Compared
to previous taste challenges.
Yeah, we'll go with that.
Would you buy it? Would you have one again?
I'd need to have plenty of liquid with it because I was about to wash it. It was very dry.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't upset me as much as Tuffy Dodgers do. Tuffy Dodger is not part of the...
It's a delicacy.
No, it's not part of the Jammy Dodger canon. It doesn't really fit in. It's like a knockoff iteration. Because it's called the Jammy Dodger, right? Jam.
But that's why they changed it to...
But they're also no longer part of the Dodger family.
It is. It's quite clearly got Dodger at the end of it.
No, it's like the kind of Dodger that dodges soap. We'll have none of that. So, yes, time is moving on. We don't want to overrun too much. So, after making... and eat that bar, then we should move on to an item of quality.
Yes, if you make it through Startup After Dark, you'll know that we gave convention, the BotCon convention comics, something of a kicking, and to be honest, mostly richly deserved given the quality of them, or lack thereof in the majority.
But here we have a slightly different animal. Now this is actually, as I hold it in my hands, the first time I've ever actually seen a physical paper copy. I've only ever seen this through other means. Online, and it was one of the many stories which were in the solicits for the Best of Simon Furman hardcover from IDW, which those of us were rather surprised to find out were actually in the advertised book, which was a shame because I was looking forward to having a print copy on it. What we're speaking of here is from BotCon 97, when it was run by 3H Enterprises, before the current license holders, Fun Publications. And it says, one and a one-issue limited series, which is a nice gag, a throwback to Marvel Comics. And we're talking of Tales from the Beast Wars Transformers, Critical Mass, by some people you may have heard of, called Simon Furman, Richard Starkings, Stephen Baskerville, and Andy Wildman. And there we go. So that was the review. Come back next time.
Yes. I think you'd like me to go into a bit more detail then.
You do like doing your comics.
Okay, so this accompanied the Botcon exclusive repaints of Terrorsaw and Rat Trap, which were called Fractal and Pack Rat exclusively. Basically, it's one of the scientists on the Predacons, Fractal, gets a new energy, basically trying to solve the problem of them staying in robot mode for too long with all the excess energy, energon on Beast Wars Earth.
Yes.
And comes up with a substance called Furmanite.
Oh.
And basically, but it turns out it's unstable and there's explosions. And it's just basically the caper to try and get it off Pack Fractal so he doesn't kill everybody. And it's basically spotlighting the two toys. It's very much in tone with some of the early Beast Wars episodes. It's not really over advancing overall story. It's a nice little romp, if you will. It's in black and white, so it's kind of there's a lot of grayscaling from Andy Wildman. Obviously, some of his early work with Photoshop.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a nice little page kind of making of some design sketches and some mock-ups for the cover. It doesn't try to do anything more than it is, which is just a little story, which is where most of the Botcon comics in current situations fall flat. Is they trying to be a big event for the sake of it, or how it is? It's like, how about just telling a story with these characters and more people will actually be interested? Which is where the one with Derek J. Wyatt and Marty Eisenberg actually works. It's like, okay, we've got these new characters, let's tell a story with them. Let's not make it a big hoo-ha, let's just tell a tale.
And also is basically a case of, let's just make a comic.
Yes.
And to put it in context, at this time, Generation 2 had finished 2 years before? 95, yeah. So there haven't been any Transformers comics for 2 years now. 2 years might not sound like a particularly long time, and in publishing terms, not really. However, what you have to remember at the time is that when Generation 2 came back and went, and there wasn't immediately any another comic, or even when Beast Wars itself launched, there was no regular comic. It looked like Transformers was dead as a dodo, comics-wise, and it was completely dead. We forget this now in an era where IDW have been putting comics out since October 2005, and there's usually a new comic almost every week, and that even between Dreamwave and IDW's first issue being published, there was less than one calendar year. So we basically had comics continuously for 10 years at this point, longer than we had any comics published during the Marvel one. But at this particular time, the idea of Transformers comics coming back was not going to happen. It was completely dead. The people who made them were off to do other things, and we were going to get cartoons, and that was it. So it was in the context of that time, it was quite a nice treat for the convention to pay for A, a comic, and B, to get back the talent who were working on the Marvel comic when it went under, namely Richard Starkings doing letters, Baskerville and Wyman on the art, and Simon Furman writing it. And you can tell that it does have a feel about it of getting the band back together for the one-off special. It's not trying to create an overlong, elaborate storyline. It's not trying to create any new fiction related to a convention. It's just trying to do, here's a wee tale that can fit in the Beast Wars if you want. Now, the only downside to it, for some people, might be that it is in black and white. And I imagine this is probably from when they just didn't have the budget to basically get colouring done or get them put in colours. I don't mind that because I'm a UK comic reader. I've grown up in black and white and colour comics. I read things like 2000 AD and Commando, which to this day still publish new black and white material. It doesn't bother me. For some of our American readers and listeners who perhaps have had less experience of black and white comic work, the look of it might turn you off initially, which would be a shame, because if you can come across a copy, and to be honest, you're unlikely to, so you might have to one, because it's not commercially available. If you can get past the lack of colour, just look at the craftsmanship of it.
It is one of these things that over this side of the pond, we are comics with colour were a novelty for quite a long time. Even And the thing is, we read 2018, which basically still purposely has material in black and white because it's just the story.
And Commando, as I said, still publishes two black and white original stories a month.
American comics seem, particularly sort of some in the more mainstream publishers, tend to have colour in by default. And you know what? Not every tale needs it. Even looking at some of the stuff from Marvel and DC over the years, you would think, you know what?
Yeah,
that would look so
and black and white can still work because that Walking Dead comic book, I believe, is rather popular.
Yes.
And that's in black and white. So, again, we're not having to go at American readers at all. We're just saying it's more than usual in your marketplace to have black and white in the mainstream. So it goes, one other thing I'd like to point out about this particular comic, which relates to us ragging on the current book on comics, is the lettering is professionally done, as in it's well done. One of the things that really irritates me about the Balkan comics of today, actually more than anything else, is the substandard lettering. Now, it's one of those things, it's a bit, even to be honest, a bit like troubling in a lot of comics. It's one of those invisible things that you notice all the time, but you don't always fully notice it until it's wrong. And then it jumps out at you like a sore dog which has just had a bad biscuit.
Yes, good lettering is the can add something to a comic. Perfect example that leaps to my mind almost immediately is John Workman with Walt Simonson on Thor.
Mm-hmm. The late Tom Frame on numerous 2000
and Judge Dredd.
Yeah,
but slightly elongated script is obviously there. People that you immediately associate with that. It's exactly the same with Transformers lettering. It is Starkings and the G2 era lettering that comes to my mind right away as kind of the pinnacle of it. Yep. That's where it was at its best.
And also it's knowing where to place the wood balloons as well. And also working at your artwork to leave spaces for wood balloons, which something that many superstar artists forget to do.
Hello, Brian Hitch.
But anyway, so that was a bit of joy for you there.
It's true.
A bit of redressing of the barns. So we'll be leaving you now and we'll leave you with this exciting cliffhanger.
What cliffhanger?
The exciting cliffhanger I'm about to reveal.
Oh, sorry, then I thought you were looking at me expectantly.
No. The exciting cliffhanger relates, in a way, to the last cliffhanger, which involved Little Philip Ayers.
Yes.
Little Philip Ayers has also delivered another term sign read for us to get our way through, which we must do before we record next podcast. I, of course, speak of Robocop, Dark Justice.
Oh, God.
An exciting DVD movie from the land of pounds.
I purposely left the other one at my house.
So, I'm seeing it on the shelf. I'm about to go and unwrap it, and in 2 weeks, or possibly 90 minutes for us, I'll tell you all about it. Goodbye!
Farewell! Seriously, I'm going to have to stop and go to Poundland.
Fuck's sake.
I'm going to have to tell Les, we need to stage an intervention.
On a fucking cake.